All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to us.
You've reached the internet's home for all things masonry. Join On the Level podcast as we plumb the depths of our ancient craft and try to unlock the mysteries, dispel the fallacies, and utilize the teachings of Freemasonry to unlock the greatness within each of us.
I have you now.
All right. Yeah. No. Save your clapping to later, folks. Welcome to On the Level podcast. I'm your host, Chris Burns. And today we have a very special guest to meet on the show with us. It's been a long time coming. This is Worshipful David Finkelstein, who is Worshipful Master of Liberty Lodge number 412, the only daylight lodge in the 23rd Masonic District of Florida. Welcome to the show, Brother Finkelstein.
Woo! Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here. I really loved your show. I think it's something very special, something that we could have used a long time ago, but of course, we didn't have you a long time ago. We probably would have. But thanks.
Well, you know what? Here's the thing. I was thinking about this morning because I asked you to come on like a week ago or something, and we kind of been planning it. I was thinking, you know, people might not know who David Finkelstein is. This podcast obviously wouldn't exist without you. I wouldn't be a Mason today if it wasn't for you. You literally saved me from leaving the fraternity at a low point for me when I was very early on, and did a lot of advisement for me. And you introduced me to a really core group of people that changed my life, like Worshipful Ramon Hernandez Rond. You kind of made those introductions for me, and you guys really did formulate my thoughts about the fraternity and like reinforced my belief that it's a good thing and that I should not let it go so quickly out of my own ignorance, really, which was the case at the time. So that being said, you know, yes, you're a past master of the lodge, and yes, you've been a committeeman for many years, and, you know, yes, you've done tons of Scottish Rite degrees, some of the hardest parts and some of the toughest degrees. Yes, you've done lectures in probably 9 lodges or more. I saw you do 2 lectures back to back, 2 different lectures in 2 different lodges on 2 different days consecutively. So I'm aware that you have a pretty hefty Masonic credentials behind you. A lot of people probably don't know that about you. Because this younger generation, they just don't ask questions. They don't know about the generation that came before them. Not to make you feel old, because generations in Freemasonry are not like generations in life. A generation in Freemasonry is like an officer line, which is like 5 years, basically. And then after 5 years, you got a whole new generation of people that don't even know what happened before them, generally speaking. So, first of all, thank you for everything that you've done for me and that you've done for the fraternity. I watched you do a lot of charitable things in silence and never took credit for it. And like me, you aren't afraid to ruffle some feathers when you feel very passionately about things. And people probably know you more for that than the things you silently did that were positive and good for people. And that is, you know, kind of like, I'm talking my ass off. I'm going to let you talk in a second. But I think that's like indicative of people that don't have a massive ego, that they are fine with being known for the fights that they fought instead of the good works that they did. Would you agree or disagree that you're a demigod?
I was about to say that I will stipulate to the historical timeline, but the rest of it's ridiculous. but thank you for saying that anyway. I appreciate that. Lyndon Johnson has something funny to say about that. He said, that's a great introduction. It's the best introduction I ever heard. Actually, the second best introduction I ever heard. The first was when the master of ceremonies got stuck in traffic and I had to introduce myself.
You think you could have done a better job?
Actually, no, I don't even remember some of that stuff. But that's kind of saying now, you, That took me a long time. I've been in masonry 15 years and took me a long time to figure things out. And you knew it intuitively and have had a tremendous influence with the, let's not hurt our arms patting each other on the back, but the membership drive that you have. I don't know how many people have heard of that, but you advertise. I don't know how you do it. I'm not in marketing, but bring in people in droves. I mean, we were having 10 and 10 and 12 size classrooms. I mean, classes, and it was really impressive. Yeah.
Well, it's like I wasn't a part of as many groups as you were before I joined the fraternity, so my ignorance probably helped me in some ways. I know you guys, like, you talked about the Rotary Club and you talked about other groups you were a part of that I didn't even know about or, you know, wasn't around. So maybe I just, out of ignorance, got, you know, I wasn't burdened with, like, previous experience in organizations, really.
Yeah.
So I didn't know what was allowed or wasn't allowed. I didn't know what people liked and didn't like. I just did what was natural to me, which got me in a lot of trouble, obviously, but it also helped a lot of people. It's kind of the dichotomy of humanism, you know? Great things come attached to human people.
Yeah.
And human people do dumb things and say dumb things all the time. And that's kind of one of the things we want to talk about today, which is brotherly love, keeping our passions within due bounds, these kind of basic tenets of Freemasonry that are really brought to us in the very beginning of our journey in Freemasonry, right? We talk about them in the lectures and our entered apprentice degrees, and then in the education we get afterwards and mentoring. So for months, we're thinking about this stuff when we first join. And then we're on to the next thing. And I don't know how many people really realize how important these things are to keep coming back to, so that you don't lose sight of what's really important.
Yeah, that's a big thing of mine, too. I think that that we should go slowly through each degree, because there's a lot there, and you're supposed to feel that, you know, that degree when you're an entered apprentice. You're supposed to be humble, deferential to me, to people that are older. And it's good to be in there for a while and feel that, and then move on to the fellowcraft and, you know, feel that step up, and then the step up to Master Mason, where you can just be, that's me.
The big debt.
Some people go through it too fast, in my opinion. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, in the state of Florida, in our jurisdiction. Oh, wow. That was an accidental cheer. I apologize for that. There was
sorry.
No kidding there.
Okay.
We are only giving these people 6 months to go through each of the three degrees, like 6 months in between degrees. Mm-hmm. And if they take any longer, we force them to come back into the lodge and get re-voted on as members, which is a little bit scary. So I think there's always that fear of, like, I don't want to go too close to 6 months because I don't want to have that whole ordeal of getting brought up for, like, now the whole lodge knows I'm taking too long, or that, you know, something's not right with me. And so I think that kind of, like, deadline really drives people to go too fast sometimes. You're right.
You know, I didn't even know that. They say when you teach a class or participate in something, you always learn something. I didn't know that. So I take back everything I said.
No, but that's the truth, because I've had classes that took over 6 months, and they you got to go back in front of the lodge and ask the craft to allow you to continue to do your work. And it's kind of like, it's not a big deal. It shouldn't be a big deal, but you know how it is. We're talking about people, so people make it a big deal. They start, like, wondering what's going on there. Is the catechism guy not doing his job? Are the students, are they thick-headed lunks? Like, what's going on with these people? So everybody has a fear of, like, I got to get it done. I got to get it done. And that's as much for the catechism instructor as the students, I think, that they feel like it's a reflection on them as to how quickly they can get their class through.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I had a thought.
You know, that's never
good. Do you mind me throwing in random thoughts? Because that's the way I run my life.
I love
Want a random thought?
Yeah.
Okay, so the catechism, I decided that, you know, back, or decided, I speculated that back in the Middle Ages, if you had a one word password, somebody might guess it, overhear it. And, you know, that meant death during the Inquisition. So I was thinking maybe that whole catechism is a one long password, because that would be hard to overhear and replicate. So that's, I have no citation for that.
Interesting thought.
And me just speculating. So,
but if it was important, they wouldn't have written it down, or everybody would have learned it. So you can't also say it's not true. What you're suggesting there might be true.
But you know, right before I came in back in 1492, there was no red book. They had been doing it mouth to ear, the whole catechisms. All the catechism.
I hear a lot of guys say that they prefer that.
Yeah.
They prefer that. I guess I can understand it. In the modern world, it's a little difficult to get, because we were doing such big classes. Like you said, we did have a 10-person class more than once.
Yeah.
And try to get 11 guys to show up at the same spot every week on time,
yeah,
and pay attention is like freaking monumental in this day and age.
Yeah.
So it can be so difficult to do it mouth to ear like that, which is, I guess, why they came up with this book, which in Florida looks like this, and it basically codes everything. So you have like a sort of reference point. You can kind of go home and study on your own.
Yeah.
If you can decipher the code, at least. And, you know, I use that a lot because, as like you, I have a gold card, and that means you have to memorize essentially everything that's in this book. And show somebody that you know it. And I bothered you, like, I know you were getting annoyed with me because I was constantly trying to get words and have you listen to me and tell me if I'm right. And other people that I was calling up at the time, I tried not to annoy one person too much, so I'd have three people I'd call for different things so that no one got really mad at me. But that's what it is when it's mouth to ear. You literally are depending on other people to get education.
Well, you know, that's, that can roll us back around to brotherhood, because I didn't for a minute feel imposed upon by you or anybody else that was learning it. Number one is because that's how I learned it. I had to call people. Number two is brotherhood means it's a relationship. That means that I think it's a symbol for the relationship we have. You know, brothers have a close relationship. Some of them, not so much.
Yeah.
But the assumption is that brothers have a close relationship. So brotherhood is a symbol for our relationship. We're not really brothers, but we call each other brothers, because brother is a symbol. So one way to look at all this is if you look for opportunities to display brotherhood. And when you call, it's an opportunity.
You're absolutely right. That is a very good point. Like, and it's something like you're new, right? When you're trying to learn this stuff and you're applying the outward rules, or what we call the profane society's rules, onto the fraternal ones.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, oh, I must be annoying this guy. But I didn't even, you know, think Masonically that you would be, as the person getting the phone call, feel like, oh, now I have an opportunity to show my lodge and everybody else how much I care about the fraternity by giving my time to this person who needs it. It's like an opportunity to show your love. And you're always waiting for that opportunity, because you can really only truly show love through your actions, right? Words are cheap.
Yeah, or sometimes you can whistle. You know, nah. Strike that. Pretty girl, but strike that. Now, there's some religions that where when somebody asks you for help, you thank them, and after you do something for somebody, you thank them because they gave you the opportunity to engage in a good deed.
So kind of like in that sense, you're showing God how much you love your God by doing something good for another human that you didn't have to do.
Yeah, that may be in some religions. The ones I'm thinking about, though, are just that you know, the world is, one of them is the world is a vessel, and God came in there and smashed the vessel, and the pieces are everywhere, and you're supposed to put them back. And that when you do a good deed, you put back one of the parts of the vessel. So you, and that's a great good deed to do that. And so a person that needs some help, and they ask you, they're doing you a good deed by letting you do them a good deed. So,
well, do you mind if I actually read what Freemasonry says to the entered apprentice about brotherly love specifically?
Yeah, that'd be great. Brotherhood?
Mm-hmm. As you know, in the entered apprentice lecture, there's a section where we talk about brotherly love and we explain it to the new initiate. And don't worry, Masons, it's not coded. It's written out. Don't call and write letters and try to get the Grandmaster to remove me. There's better things to do that about. This is written out and we're allowed to talk about it. By the exercise of brotherly love, we are taught to regard the whole human race as one family. So now it's going beyond just my friend in Freemasonry. They're saying brotherly love as a Mason means you love every living person as a family member, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The high, the low, the rich and the poor, who being created by one almighty parent and inhabitants of the same planet, ought to aid, support, and protect each other. I always laugh when I say that part in the lecture because it makes it almost ridiculous how we don't treat each other properly, you know? Like, we're inhabitants of, we have the same almighty parents, whether you're born in Istanbul or Florida, we share the same parentage and we're living here on the same planet. We have to share the same air, resources, water. We should support and protect each other. We shouldn't divide and fight each other.
Yeah.
On this principle, Masonry unites men of every country, sect, and opinion and conciliates true friendship among those who might otherwise have remained at a perpetual distance. That's what we tell entered apprentices about brotherly love and what Masonry means when they talk about brotherly love. And it's so true, right? Like, you and I only met because of the fraternity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we've had a very close friendship that's spanned 7 years or something now.
It's been 7 years, really? Wow.
You've been in my home for Thanksgiving 1 year. We had Thanksgiving dinner together, our families. And I've been, you know, we've been with you through some challenges you've had in the hospitals and stuff. Yeah. You know, yeah. I've come to you for advice over the years, and you give me counsel that I sometimes listen to, and to your chagrin, sometimes don't listen to. But I always appreciate it. That's a relationship in my life that's really important to me. And we've also had our differences. This is really important, I think, to share. We've had big blow-up fights over the years. But one of us calls the other the next day and says, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it's like, you know, it doesn't matter what happens. I'm always going to love you. You're my brother. Right? You can never say anything bad enough to me that the next day I'm not going to be like, it's okay. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, you told me that once. You said, you know, I'll always be your friend no matter what happens. That's, you know, that's there. I might get mad at you. I may, you know, have to turn you in and put you in jail. You didn't say that part, but I'm always going to love you. And that meant a lot.
I would do it. And I would come visit you in jail.
Yeah. Great. Makes a big difference.
Bring you some cigarettes and other currencies that would make your life easier.
That's right. Now you said something that I was going to remark on. Can't remember. I'm getting old.
How old are you now?
68. Can you believe that?
68?
I do look 68. Okay, I'll keep the hat on.
And in your home life, you're a lawyer? Is that your profession?
I'll admit to that.
And you were a CPA in a former life.
We'll be right back. Joseph M. Wanted with the Christitutionalist Politics. Tune in for the upcoming episode for May 4, Issue Never the Issue, as well as guests Peter Serafin, Rosemary Downer, Don Gallade, Gista the Rapper, Cy Young, Jason Perry, and upcoming Jack Hagar, Andrew Thorpe King, Trent Rock, Ed Temple, Chris Morehouse, and more. Please tune in to Christitutionalist Politics. God bless.
Well, yeah, well, I didn't really practice CPA, but 2 years so I could get my entered apprentice. They have an apprenticeship in CPAs with CPA, so I did that for 2 years, and then I became a lawyer because that's what I'd always wanted to be, was a lawyer.
You always wanted to be a lawyer?
Yeah. And
you just like arguing, or was it about helping people? What was the drive there?
It's kind of a weird drive for a little kid, but I said, you know, I asked my cousin, you know, I like science. I said, where do astronomers work? And they said, well, they work at universities and things like that. And I said, well, who are they? I said, so do they all do that? And they said, yeah, they have to. And I thought, well, I don't want to work for the government because they may cut back my funding. And I was like 12 or 10. And I said, I'm going to stay away from that. And most sciences work for some big organization, and a lot of them, the government or funded by government. And so I said, forget that. So I thought I'd be an independent person and be a lawyer.
And the irony of that is your daughter worked for the government.
That's right. That's right. And she
still got one of you.
But she's a lot more mellow. You know, they were going to cut off funding. She was going to not get paid. And she just said, oh, well, I'll walk dogs or something. And so she's a lot more mellow than me.
Well, it's true. You know, if the government cuts you off, you just go work for a private company and lobby the government. There's always money around the government one way or the other.
Yeah. And I learned a lot. One thing is, I mean, we're getting far afield. You know, I'm not even going into that. All right, no. So let's talk a little bit more about brotherhood. Oh. So I'm going to give you one example. I have many where what's your name? Chris bailed me out. I was working really hard and wasn't sleeping much. And I put together a talk on mental health. And so I went to the talk, wasn't feeling all that great, feeling tired. And I introduced the speaker, sat down, and promptly fell out, passed out.
You were passed out.
And, you know, everybody apparently was, you know, oh gosh, what happened? And fortunately, we have a medic named Robert Leonard, who's currently the worshipful master of Liberty Lodge. Great guy. And he checked me out and he said, he's fallen asleep. He's just asleep. So Chris and Scott Wren came and got me and took me home and made sure I was, I don't know what you did. I was out of it. Was my wife there? Did you tell her on that?
She wasn't there.
So what did you do? You just shoved me in the door or what did you do?
Well, actually, we put you on the couch. Scott wasn't there. It was just me. And you were able to walk, but not really well. And I put you on the couch. And you were adamant that you had just forgotten that you had taken your medication, and you took your medication twice. And you said you just needed to sleep it off. So I left you there on your couch. And I got a call from you 12 hours later telling me you just woke up.
That's funny. I don't remember that.
Apparently, you slept on the couch for 12 hours after I dropped you off.
That's great. That's great. Apparently, I needed it. Well, you know, that's another good thing about masonry. It can help you with the sleep. You know, if you're in the lodge and they start reading the minutes, you know, you can catch up on your sleep.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. The minutes will put you right to sleep.
Yeah. But no, you're required to. And there's a lot of good reasons. You know, we want to make sure everything's written down right.
This is probably the only time I'll ever see it, but there was a similar situation to the one you just described, but I wasn't at the place. I was summoned to you because you needed help. And when I arrived, you were sitting outside on a bench and you were in distress. And it's the only time probably I'm ever going to see the actual Grand Healing Sign of Distress used because you gave it. And you were in distress and you weren't able to articulate that. But you were conscious enough to know that there was a way you could get help. And Masons listening will know what I'm talking about. Wow. He did express it, and he did receive it, and it worked the way it's supposed to work.
Wow, that's pretty
amazing.
That's pretty neat. You know, there's lots of things we find as masonry goes on, but that's got to be the most impressive to me. That's I'd forgotten about that. And thank you for reminding me about that. And I appreciate it. I really do. This guy, a great mason.
I always say that masonry is giving us like training wheels for life. And so we're able to have these close, caring relationships with people that are masons because they're our brother. What Freemasonry tells us, we're supposed to treat the whole world this way. Even people we don't know, even people we don't like, even people that are different than us or richer than us or poorer than us, we're supposed to treat them with the same compassion. And so I've always found it a great challenge to try to take these lessons that we reaffirm all the time in lodges and take them out into the world and try to practice it with people that aren't close to us, that we don't know, try to show that same love for them. And that can be a challenge in today's world, yeah, which is not really used to that kind of behavior amongst people.
You know, what you said is actually one of the purposes of masonry, and some people tell you it is the purpose of masonry, to have you become a better person and then send you out into the profane world. That's a funny word to me. It makes me think of people walking around cussing or something.
I thought it was a derogatory word. Yeah, the first time I heard it, I thought that's a really derogatory way to talk about people.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, I'm sorry, go ahead.
A lot of words that like are in the fraternity are old words that had different meanings when they were used. Yeah. And now have been kind of like, you know, slangified and mean something a little different. Like to us, you said profane. It's true. When I heard it, I thought, oh, this, why do they call us like that? Like, not everybody's profane. We don't all go around F this, F that. But when I Googled it, profane meant something else in old English.
Like commonplace or something?
Yeah, something just like not of or not having the knowledge of or just being outside of enlightenment kind of. It didn't mean like a derogatory thing like we take it to mean. Same with worshipful.
Yeah,
when Americans hear worshipful, they're like, oh, this isn't good. I don't want to worship anybody. But that's not what it means. Heck, in England, they still call judges worshipful, right?
I think. Sure do. Mm-hmm.
So it has just totally different meaning. And you're one of the people that tries to squash that pretty quick. I know when you meet with new entered apprentices, that's like one of the first things you're tackling is, I know what you're all thinking. Worshipful doesn't mean we're going to get down and worship this guy, okay? And then you start to explain what it means so that they have a better like understanding of the concept of these teachings. And don't run wild with your imagination.
One of the things I tell them is, you know, I was a worshipful, and people certainly didn't worship me. They were like the opposite. Well, not the opposite, but they didn't bow and do my bidding.
I guess you could have ordered them to.
Yeah, right. I could have ordered them. I could have ordered a pony, and I wouldn't have gotten either one of them. That's one of my favorite sayings when somebody says, I want to do this. I go, yeah, and I want a pony. Kind of the equivalent of when Dr. Phil says, how's that working for you?
How's that working for you?
Yeah.
Well, but that, you know, that part of the statement of brotherly love, which is that we meet people that through the fraternity, we definitely never would have associated with without the fraternity.
Yeah.
That's true. And it is one of the great things of joining our fraternity is that you will mingle with people that you wouldn't normally mingle with and develop really close relationships with them, which is good for you as a person.
It's good for you,
your little circle.
Yeah, it really is. We need that, and we don't have it in this world. We used to, I'm going to the, you've heard all of these, these are subjective lectures and mentoring talks. One is that, I was listening. I never actually read the book. Yeah, I did go back and read the book. But there was a guy talking about a book he had written, and he said that people need to be in tribes. That's the way we evolved, or the way God made us. And in today's, ever since the car was invented, the beginning of the last century, people don't live in tribes anymore. Neil Young has a saying about, I mean, in a line, in a song talking about, you know, Native Americans. And he says that, you know, that we used to roam the plain and now he lives in his little box at the top of the stairs by himself. And that's not helpful. And no matter where you are, you'll make a, you know, group of people will turn it into a tribe. A block, you know, in big cities like New York City, there's a block and you don't do certain things on somebody else's block and you're gone at a certain time. And
the modernization of that, if you think about it, has made it more dangerous because it used to be, like you said, a block, like a geography thing, right? Like where you live was kind of going to be your tribe. You didn't have much say in it. That's just the way it was. Yeah. But now with the advent of the internet, people are making their tribes with people they may never meet all over the world. And they're wearing their hats and their little patches and they go out and they maybe even protest locally. And the people around them are like, who are you? What are you doing? But they feel like they're part of something and they feel like they found a tribe that understands them and accepts them. And the internet's made it so different than it ever was meant for us as like a species and evolution, you know, where it is a physical geography thing where you're probably going to grow up around people and live with them and have to deal with them. And your neighboring block or tribe might not feel the same way and you might fight with them and war with them. Here on the internet, it's like, you know, they can find a tribe of people that are in Germany from Florida you hear about people being radicalized into terrorism in the United States through the internet. And it's crazy how dangerous it can be because, you know, I think the internet doesn't do a good job of identifying truth from false. It kind of makes all information subjective. Like people can just choose what the truth is now. I think that's a really, really dangerous thing for us as a people to get away from because we do need tribes. I mean, we are wired to be with other people to feel satisfied and part of something. And people are always going to seek that out. But the internet always kind of distills things to the lowest common denominator. So when you go on the internet looking for your tribe, even if it starts cosplaying as something innocent, it's going to eventually get to a dark place where you may not even know it, but you could potentially be radicalized into some crazy religion or cult.
I'm not really in any tribes on the internet.
You're 68, you said, right? 66?
What's that?
You're 60.
66 tribes.
66? So, like, when the internet came about, you were already a grown man.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you had very lived a life and formed relationships, and you knew what that meant. So why would good someone point. Like that go seeking that out on the internet? It doesn't make very sense.
Very good point. Yeah.
But these kids who grew up with nothing but the internet, they don't know about the childhood you had, you know, where you had to go play with people. You had to work with people. Sometimes that were scary and that you didn't like, and you had to learn how to deal with that. They don't have that life today. It's crazy.
That's a good point. You can just disconnect. Also, everybody pumps up what they're doing. So you're not interacting with the actual person. You're interacting with a fictional version of that person.
It's like you curate only the highlights of someone's life and put it out there. And people see that as the reality of a life when it's curated, like specialized highlight reel of a life. It's not really that person's life.
Yeah.
That information isn't getting to the children. They're believing stuff that they see online is real.
Is that the way the world is just going to be from now on?
I think so. I don't see how you take the fire out once you give it to people. Right?
Mm-hmm.
When Prometheus brought it to us, he was like in big trouble because he can't take it back.
You know, I knew Prometheus. I'm very old. I knew Prometheus. He was a nice guy.
I didn't know you were Greek. Was he Greek or Roman?
He was a Roman guy. Yeah, they had the same. They had the same people, but they just gave them new names, like Zeus and Jupiter were the same person.
Is Christianity and Catholicism used like kind of the same generally? Catholics are just Christian, right? When you talk about Christians in Ireland.
They're the first Christians and the most, I guess you would say most Orthodox, or one of the most Orthodox.
Well, they came from the Roman Catholic Church, which is where Christianity originated, I guess, probably, right?
No, that's where it spread a lot then, but Christianity had been around for a while, and the Romans persecuted Christians for a long time. And then one of the, I can't remember one, everybody else probably knows it, one of the emperors decided, you know, he looked at Christianity and he says, yes, that's the truth. And he said that, to all the Romans. And then, you know, the Romans were wandering around, you know, and to countries and taking them over. And so they brought their religion with them. I think that's how it happened. I think they were still wandering around at that point.
And everything they saw was theirs, right? Hey, there's some land. That's ours, too. Hey.
Yeah.
Look at that. That's nice. That's ours, too.
Yeah, that brings up the word superfluity, because they didn't need it. It was unnecessary, and it was tacky that they would want it, but they went and got it anyway. Kind of like hoarders that you hear about, where they've got 16 cats, you know, 15 or 14 of them are superfluous. I was going to talk about that word too, and that was a good segue into it.
So let me tell you my experience with the word superfluity.
Sure.
There are so many great unknown people in our fraternity. Before I even joined the fraternity, before I was an entered apprentice, I was going to Phoenix Lodge number 346, is where I was going to be initiated in Sarasota. And there was a gentleman there named Albert Dahl.
Yeah.
Very similar to you. He was holding these like Masonic groups where you would just get together and talk about Masonic stuff. And I got invited to one before I was even an entered apprentice. And I didn't know what was going on or what to expect. He handed out playing cards to everybody around the round table and said, I want everyone one at a time to flip over your card. And I've written some words there. And I want you to tell me the first things that come to your mind when you see the word. And, you know, my word was wisdom, so I didn't have a whole lot of Masonic experience to draft, like, say what this means. So the first thing that came to my mind with wisdom was, oh, it's the accumulation of mistakes. Like, you know, that's what I think of was wisdom. And people think a wise man never made a mistake. No, he made the most mistakes, the wise guy. He's done all mistakes. But another guy next to me got superfluity. Now, I never heard the word superfluity. I thought it was a made-up word.
Mm.
And they started to talk about to them what came up when that word was said. And they were very Masonic things they were saying, but as a non-Mason, I didn't really get it. And then, obviously, as an entered apprentice, I heard it again, and I realized how Masonic the word is. And now in hindsight, I look back at it, and like we were talking before the recording, you found a reference to the word in the King James Bible.
Yeah.
So
that was the first reference to it. linguists have great respect for the King James Bible. More than that, it's like a Bible to them. That and Shakespeare. That's where a lot of our words came from. They were crafted in the King James Bible. And I don't know if I read this right, but I think it said, this was in on vocabulary.com. You know me, I like to give citations. And they said, I think they said that it was the first use of it in James 1.
Oh, really?
21.
That's the first use of it they can find?
Yeah, and it said, and there's a lot of words like that, a lot of words in Shakespeare too. And I think they might have been around the same time. Anyway, this is the quote, James 1:21. Wherefore, lay apart all filthiness and superfluity of naught is and receive, I must have left that word, and receive the meekness and something word which is able to save your souls. I sometimes can't read my writing, but filthiness and superfluity and several, the Merriam-Webster dictionary calls it immoderate and especially luxurious. Kind of like a Tesla. He drives a Tesla.
Hey, superfluid is.
Yeah, like a shopaholic. is a super, super foolish person.
Yeah.
Vocabulary.com said it's so unnecessary that it can be done away with. Charles Stoddard, who apparently walked around glaciers in 1899, said, let's see, for a climb over glaciers, the very thickest shoes are absolutely necessary. All else seems superfluous to me. So, got a very negative connotation. A lot of people didn't know what it was until Jerry Gotcher told us, and also he told us how to pronounce it, and he was right, according to these dictionaries. We just kind of glanced over it. And we do that, not just with strange words, we do that with our own words. For instance, brotherhood, you know, we all talk about it, we think, no, what is your definition? Or did I already ask you that?
No, you haven't.
Okay, what is your definition of brotherhood? Or not definition, but what do you think of it as?
Well, the word brotherhood, to me, it's identifying like a group of people that are brothers, meaning that you take care of each other. So a fraternity is a brotherhood in that it's a group of men that treat each other like brothers and that they take care of each other like family. That's what brotherhood means to me.
That's good. That's good. Good definition. Well, brotherhood, if you dig down a little bit, drill down a little bit into the thought, you'll find areas where you have an opportunity to demonstrate brotherhood. And my big one for the last, I don't know, 5 years or so has been, you know, we show brotherhood to each other. We need to show brotherhood. We have the opportunity to show brotherhood to the new brothers.
Yeah.
And to the petitioners and to an EA, because that's a place where it really makes a difference. You know, it's wonderful that, you know, if I see you at a lodge, I'll smile, trade a few words. And to me, that's brotherhood. When you say, how do you do? Louis Armstrong said, neighbors passing saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. So that's a brotherhood that we have. But there's a much greater opportunity. I don't want to, there's another opportunity that's great. The people, many of them these days who come to our lodge, and you've seen this more than me, you say, why did you come here? And they say, because I don't have any friends. And I wanted to have some friends. And of course we tell them that, you know.
Yeah.
And
honestly, that's one of the reasons I joined. The idea of a fraternal group, which means it's only dudes. I didn't have any male friends my whole life. So I was seeking out like friends, like you just said. On a certain level, that is one of the reasons I joined.
How do you like them now that you've experienced them?
I've been through a roller coaster on that. Like in the beginning, I just believed everything 100% that I was told. And then what happens is it's kind of like your first divorce is how I feel about it. Like when I was married for the first time, and I thought divorce was just a thing on TV and movies. Like I didn't think it was real or could happen to me. And when my marriage fell apart, my whole world crashed. Like everything I believed was, I had to question now because I had believed so much that this was a forever thing. And so joining the lodge, all the tenants of the fraternity, I had the same experience, like an idiot. I just believed everything. And I thought everybody would think and act the way that we're told to. And in reality, it's not the case. A lot of people don't take it seriously. And they just continue to act profane, even though they're Masons. And I had a very radical period of time where I thought it was all made up. And now I've come to a place where I realize, oh, people are just people. Like the people that that took the time to think through a system and put it into place, cared about it so passionately that they wanted to transmit it through time. And it's really up to us to keep it alive and going and not let it die, because these are important ideals, things we're never going to live up to. You and I, or nobody's ever going to live up to these ideals. But it's the act of trying that makes us good. So I've come to the realization that men are just men, and it doesn't matter if you're in politics or if you're in Freemasonry or it's in your own home. you'll love and hate the same person.
Yeah.
And it's just the humanity, the nature of being human. And so what makes us good is that we keep trying to do better.
That's beautiful. That really is.
And this fraternity gives us those things to try to be good at, and it gives you a way to do it. And even some exercises and tools and things to visualize and think about, like, it really does give us a way to improve ourselves if we're willing to try to do it.
It sure improved me. I was, before Masonry, I was so obnoxious. I didn't even like having myself around. But the one thing
you didn't
that.
Like yourself?
No, I thought it was okay. But anyway, we're really getting into the weeds here. But one thing I wanted to say is that there's a movie called The Verdict. And movies have, I'm a lawyer, and they have wonderful closing arguments. You know, they got a team of writers writing them. And the one in The Verdict was especially good. And he started off by talking about the Supreme Court building. It says equality, justice and equality for all. And he asked the jury, he says, is that a description of us? Is that an accurate description of us? Is that a guarantee? And he said, no. And I always get goosebumps when I get to this part. He said, it's a prayer.
Yeah.
It's a prayer that we'll have equal justice for all. And that's what, you know, these Masonic principles are.
Yeah, you know,
something we strive for. And Masonry recognizes that and says everywhere.
Yeah.
It's not perfection that we're looking for.
Right.
And someone once told me if we were all following a rule, you wouldn't need the rule in the first place.
Yeah.
Rules are there so that we follow them when we weren't going to.
That's true. By the way, The Verdict is a 1982 American legal drama film, and it starred Paul Newman.
Yeah, that's just talking to the jury, and it's great. And he says the you know, we impanel juries, and the legislature can't affect this, the Supreme Court can't, well, they can't, the president can't affect it, the judge can't. And he said, there's only one person that can give justice to my client, and then he goes, it's you, ladies and gentlemen. And that just
the
way
jury.
He says it. It just really, that's a good movie. I recommend it.
Well, how cool is it? Because you're in the legal profession. And I feel like the legal system, our American government system, are all fraternal extensions of this fraternity, right? Like, this country was founded on the principles of the Masons who built it. And I think the legal system is kind of part of that. And Masonry has its own legal system and rules and Masonic Digest. And so how do you as a lawyer see the similarities between the Masonic, like Masonic Law Digest and our Masonic trial system and the American government system? Or is that something I'm imagining in my head?
No, you're right. And it's a huge question. And spare me a little time to say it. There have always been courts, but they weren't always as desirous of being fair and keeping
impartial
people free.
Justice. Yeah,
you know, the kangaroo or the courts out in the woods. They call them I forgot. They call them some great. It's a great name. But anyway, so this brings up something that. Is a topic I was going to maybe do if we had time. There's things we don't know about Masonry, just Masons all the time, because you can't.
Yes.
And a lot of it's not in there.
Right.
In the books or the lectures.
And the books are really all we have, right? Like, there's no oral tradition outside the books these days.
Well, I think this is an oral tradition. You know, we haven't cited the books, but just a little while. And this, since this is laudatory and, you know, a little flowery, what I'm going to say, I think it's part of the oral tradition. One of the things that we don't recognize enough, or even say enough, or even know, is that, and I'm not saying this because it's our organization, and yay, our organization, but Freemasonry is one of the noblest institutions in the world and history because of what I'm going to tell you. It's almost a fact. I mean, the word noblest has to be an opinion, but if you know what the facts that I'm going to tell you are facts. Prior to the 1700s, the late 1700s, freedom was unknown. You know, we take it for granted. We don't take it for granted. We talk about it all the time. The land of the free and the home of the brave. I can't remember the guy's name who says, "I'm proud to be American, or at least I know I'm free."
Yeah.
There's dozens of songs like that, maybe more. We do appreciate our freedom, but I don't know how much, I don't know if anybody knows except Tomas Zentner, the smartest person I know. Sorry, Chris.
I don't claim to be smart. Doesn't hurt my feeling. And I know Tomas is a genius, so
he's
we
really
need to get
smart.
Him on the podcast to talk about the Enlightenment and some of the things he's passionate about, because people would love to hear it.
You do, because he will, rather than me, he'll actually say accurate things. So it's
and he sounds exactly like you would think a vampire should sound like.
He's mongry. Yeah.
Yes, Chris, right. I will do it.
Yeah.
We'll have him on. You'll see. I'm gonna put Count Dracula and him next to each other, voice to voice. You'll be like, I can't deal with it.
Yeah, I see him every 2 weeks. We have a principles philosophy and principles class.
Yes.
And he's really into that and very knowledgeable. But here's what happened. You know, you see TV shows. What's that one that was so popular with the blonde headed girl that everybody was always getting naked and all excited about? Game of Thrones. Is that it?
Oh, Game of Thrones. Okay.
Yeah. You know, that if you notice, there's no voting booths there and there's no election signs.
Yeah. It was kings and.
Right. And, you know, in our fairy tales that we read kids, you know, there's a prince and. Beautiful, and he makes this woman princess. You don't see, you don't hear about, you know, same. You don't hear about that stuff because it didn't exist.
Yeah,
the idea of people, just regular people, deciding things for themselves, just wasn't there. There were kings and lords, and it was even worse than that because the people that lived on the land were basically slaves. You know, they're not in the, and, you know, they weren't chained in the thing that you normally think about as slaves, but they were serfs. And if you look up serfs, and that's with an E, if you look up with a U, you'll get the Beach Boys songs. There's nothing wrong with that. But this is serfs. And Masonry comes from the tradition of, in England, there were a couple of revolutions. One of them worked and one of them didn't. The English Civil War and the Glorious Revolution. And a lot of people came out of that philosophizing and talking about freedom. John Locke.
The Peasants' Revolution? Is that one of them that you're talking about?
What's that?
I remember there was one called the Peasants' Revolution or something like that.
Yeah, there were littler ones too. Yeah, my favorite one is the first one because of the guy that led it. It was named Robert the Bruce. I just think that's a great name. I was thinking about changing my name to David the Nathan, but
nice.
I haven't.
That would make me like Chris the Burns. So what does that mean? Mm-hmm. I go around burning people like with my words or like with hot things. I don't know.
Maybe you were a fire watcher. Your family's were.
Well, Robert the Bruce has he has ties to the fraternity.
Oh, he does. Like, I didn't know that.
If
That's
you go
cool.
through the Scottish Rite, the later degrees are all about the Knight of St. Andrews, and supposedly the order of the Knights of St. Andrews was formed under Robert the Bruce in
That's
Scotland.
Great. And we learned about, Masons learned about, you know, people voting and working together and the power in the people because they were building cathedrals and You know, you couldn't just ignore a person and put them out there like a machine. They had to be, they had to exercise their own judgment. I'm told that on aircraft carriers, the lowest man in the ship can stop the ship. He can call the admiral and say of the ship, say, stop the ship. And he will.
That's
you guys
important.
Are in a lot of trouble if you just made it up. But but that's how that works. You know, if he sees an iceberg or a goldberg or anything like that, that's a joke.
Well, you need to do that. I mean, I right before this podcast, I was in the middle of watching a Netflix documentary, like a 9-part series on the Cold War and the nuclear, the advent of the nuclear weapon and its impact on society. And I'm only on episode like 6, and there's already been 3 cases where entire annihilation of all life on Earth hinged on one person.
Yeah.
Exercising human judgment and not following the system that was set up, because the system is set up for war. The system is set up to be aggressive. The system is to either respond or initiate aggression. And the only thing that saved all life on Earth 3 times so far in this documentary, and they interview the people, is people saying, let me think about this first. Hold on a second. And those people were right. In one case, a 50-cent electronic piece caused people monitoring the equipment to think there were 2,000 nuclear warheads headed to the United States.
God.
50-cent equipment malfunctioned. And the people should have done their job and told the president, who would have obviously immediately retaliated. And they knew that. And so they didn't. And they waited and they looked closer. And turns out, you know, they were right. But it's a person, one person. And so you need a system where every single person can, you know, have an effect on the end result, like you just said.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have these military type or authoritarian type situations where there's a system that funnels everything to one person whose goal is aggression, it's never going to go well for anybody.
Yeah.
Masonry is a system like that. Yes, we do have a grandmaster, but he doesn't walk around like a dictator. He answers to the brothers, right?
Yeah.
He essentially only has power during the Grand Lodge session, which lasts for 3 days.
Yeah.
Even then, he's just bringing up legislation that's voted on by the brothers in a very democratic process. So Freemasonry, you said it came out of the Enlightenment, which makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
Like people wanted to get away from this authoritarian system, which clearly doesn't work for society. Go closer to a place where every man's voice should be heard and weighed in order to have a better outcome for the common good of everybody.
And it was so unheard of as to be bizarre. You know, the kings were just the way, you know, they said they got their power from God. You know, to vote on stuff, you know, to ask all the serfs and everybody was just a ridiculous thing. It would be like saying to put a dog in charge of the presidency of the United States. It was just weird. But Masons wrote about it for years and years. And I don't know if John Locke was a Mason. A lot of people claim him to be. I think he just hung out with a lot of Masons. I don't think he was actually a Mason. People like Voltaire, and what I told my Mason classes is, if you ever want to sound smart, say Voltaire. It just sounds intellectual. Doesn't it sound intellectual?
It does. I want to know more about Voltaire. I don't know anything about it.
You don't need to know about him. You just need to quote him. You just need to say his name.
But I actually want to be smart. I don't want to just sound smart.
That's so sad.
How does that happen?
He was a Mason. And he was...
Oh, he was? Voltaire?
Yeah. Very, writer, very, very... Huh? What's that?
Voltaire was a writer?
He was a philosopher and a writer.
A philosopher, okay.
And a big thinker. And he had, you know, radical ideas as well. He was one of the people in this, one of the steps along the way that brought us to the 1700s, late 1700s, where we actually started doing things about it. And you know, we all are very proud of our founding fathers and of the American Revolution. But that's another thing we don't realize, how monumental that was.
Yeah,
they threw off the king. Nobody had done that. Oliver Cromwell threw off the king, King Charles II, I think. But then he became a king, kind of. And some lists of the kings of England actually put his name in there as one of the kings. So that really didn't have much to do with the common man. But there's a book. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, I thought you were done there. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that there's a book. I forgot the name of. Oh, The Cousins Wars. Instead of brothers, you know, the movements in England, the ones here, were not quite brothers, were cousins.
Yeah.
And so he said that the English Civil War, the American Revolution, and the Civil War were all one war. They were all about the same thing. And that was the common man against the aristocracy. In the Civil War, I'm from the South, and a lot of us talk about, you know, we needed this, we wanted that, but it was really only the aristocracy that pushed for the war. First of all, they were the only ones that could vote then, I think. So the people that, you know, in the North who had come over from Ireland and places like that where people were oppressed, they saw it as a common man versus the aristocracy. They looked at the South as an aristocracy. They get right off the boat and go fight. And they came in great numbers. I'm not sure we would have won the war. The North would have won the war without all the Irish that came over. They were they had been very oppressed. They were, you know, very, very motivated to throw off an England. It was like an England to them.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah. And there was a lot of support for the American Revolution in England. People
to this day, you know, the Irish people are very on the side of the little man, the little country, the underdog. Yeah. When I went to Ireland with my wife a couple of years ago, and they had so many places that they were housing Ukrainian refugees. So many. Like, and I'm thinking, this is such a small country, and I'm seeing so many more Ukrainian refugees here than in my home country, which could actually house a hell of a lot more.
Yeah.
And when I asked the people, like, why? Because my wife is Ukrainian, so obviously this caught our eye. And my wife was like, "What is up with this?" And they said, "We feel their pain. Like, it's much closer in their history to them than it is to us. The oppression that they dealt with, that they're still holding on to today, and so they have an empathy for others that are in a similar situation."
Yeah, the way things that were put together didn't end until when Clinton was president. He went over there and got them to sign it up. I mean, it was about to happen anyway, but he got them to sign it up. Another thing I want to say about the Irish, they get around. There's one of the founding fathers, also a Mason, of South America, all the countries of South America. Well, there were two of them. One was named Simón Bolívar. He was a Mason. The guy that freed Mexico and Cuba were Masons. Especially in the Western Hemisphere, a lot of the people that brought about freedom, a lot of the freedom
people. He's from Venezuela.
Was also Simón Bolívar, because at first, South America wasn't broken into countries. It was later broken into countries after they had already gained their freedom. So he's the, you know, founding father of, you know, three quarters of the states there, and maybe more. So like one country has as its currency, the Bolivar, and there's other things, other people like that. But the other guy was, I always think, first time I heard it, I still laugh at it, because it's such a testament to how the Irish went all over the world and did great things. The other guy's name was Bernardo O'Higgins. That was one of the founding fathers of South America, Simón Bolívar and Bernardo O'Higgins. And he was a Mason. So there were
really,
yeah. And actually, when I was talking about Voltaire, he was initiated by Jefferson, who was a Mason.
Huh. Well, that makes sense. He's a French writer, and I'm sure Jefferson was. He was all about the French for a while there.
Yeah, yeah.
He was an ambassador, right? To France?
Yeah, he was sent over there. George Washington sent him over there to try to get the French on our side, and he did.
Yeah.
And I think that won the war for us because we had a big fleet, and we had no fleet. And England had a big fleet. Lafayette was also, I have that wrong. No, I don't. Lafayette was also a Mason. So Jefferson went over to France, a Mason, talked to another Mason there, Lafayette, who was the admiral of all the fleet. Got him to bring over, or the next thing you know, he brought over the fleet. England had the biggest fleet probably there ever was. And we would never, you know, they were blockading us. There wasn't anything we could do. But the French, they fought them real well and defeated them here and there. And then another Franklin. Franklin went to Germany. I think it was Franklin, Ben Franklin. And he met up with a Mason there named von Steuben. And von Steuben came to America to help out, too. And his help was that he organized the army, got them.
He helped out Washington's army, right?
Yeah, Washington's army. Made him organize, you know, taught him tactics. So, but now, let me back up one more. Do we still have time? Okay.
There's no limits on us. We have unlimited time.
Maybe we can make it a part one and a part two and three and four.
Hold on. We have unlimited time. That's much better than I could be.
I like that when you do that. It cracks me up. That's one of those little things about you that endear you to everybody. Maniacal laugh.
So let me ask you, over the years, you and I, we go way off the reservation when we talk.
We do. Yeah.
Normal people would listen to us and think we're insane because we both follow an idea to its logical conclusion, wherever that leads. Okay. Yeah. It can sound ridiculous, but I have been thinking, and you kind of alluded to this in the beginning, that humans are tribal. It's in our genetics to be a tribal people.
Mm-hmm.
I would go further and say that it's in our genetics to be followers. That we probably survived because a strong person led other people. There's something in us also to follow people. And in order to do that, they can't be normal. You have to lift them up and make them something greater than you in order for you to die for what they're going to tell you to do. And this is something that we've seen throughout our history forever, as long as we've had recorded history. We always coalesce behind a strong man, right? Mm. Always. Mm-hmm. And then here comes the Enlightenment, where you've got educated people saying, wait a second, there's something within each of us important and critical to our survival, and we probably won't continue to thrive if we let our genetics and our animal brain follow a strong man for the rest of time. And you look at human history, like we had hunter-gatherers, right, for how many hundreds of thousands of years, and then we had agriculture came onto the scene, and we advanced much more quickly because we had time to think. We weren't always just hand to mouth anymore. We were like, oh, we have like shelter and food and like we can now sit and think. And we started this technological path that, you know, in the matter of hundreds of years got us to just basic agrarian life to technology and building things. And in the last 50 years, technology skyrocketed so fast that we've gone from, you know, radio being like the pinnacle, which I think we were both alive for the time when radio was the pinnacle of technology and the way that we communicated, to now we have satellites in orbit that beam signals everywhere on the planet all the time at will. And that's only happened in the last 50, 60 years, right? Like, yeah. Our evolution is speeding up. And it's because the further we get away from the pulls of nature, which is follow a strong man, be afraid of things in the dark, like make up stories for things we can't understand, to like, let's really get our heads together. Let's get our shit together. Let's cooperate. Let's like work together truly as a people. We see ourselves skyrocketing in success as a species. So in my mind, we have to get away from the thinking of follow a strong man, and we have to get more into a democratic world, not just country, but world, if we're going to survive as a species, because the technology is advancing too fast. And if we can't get a handle on it, the strong man is going to use the technology in a way that will end all life for all of us.
Yeah.
Is that crazy thinking? Or is
no, that's, too bad? That's very, very interesting, and it dovetails with so many things that I've read, and they're in this overcrowded mind of mine. It dovetails with all of that. The strong man, you know, politicians are bad for that. You know, Putin is a strong man. He appeals to people's fear, which is a very basic part of us. We've got the basic part, which is animalistic and just, you know, you see a bear, you run. You don't think about it. Oh, what's that bear doing there? And then you've got the cortex, which thinks. I read something. This is off the beaten track of the beaten track. So I'm just going to go ahead with this. It's like this.
Just light that on fire. You don't need that.
A lot of the people that were serfs, you know how you talk to yourself in your mind?
Yeah.
And you say, I'm the Queen of Sheba. No, you talk to yourself in your mind.
It's never good for me. It's always like some negative crap I'm feeding myself about. You're stupid. You're dumb. You shouldn't have said that. Like, my voice is really annoying. I don't know about yours.
Mine is weird.
Is it?
Mine connects weird things. Things that don't have affection. And they come out as jokes sometimes. But one of the things that the lower mind cannot, it does not have the ability to understand or implement logic. It just doesn't exist for the lower mind. So, and not that long ago, they started a series of studies that said that when you're talking politics, you're using that lower mind that has no logic. And you'll see people talking and they'll contradict themselves. Enlightenment, we've got to go. Well, I just want to say one thing. The Enlightenment brought rationality into focus.
Yeah.
Thinking things through instead of being an animal. And so that's why it was so effective and so different.
And out of the Enlightenment came modern democracy.
It came at the same time. It came right along with it.
Yeah.
That was part of the plan. They said, I think it was John Locke that said, there's natural law and there's natural rights. And from that, from logic steps, he got to the point that we have inalienable rights.
Hmm.
So that, you know, that came right from Masonry.
You're obviously very educated person. Like I said, you got your CPA's license, you're a practicing attorney. These aren't like things the average Joe accomplishes in their life. And you read a lot, probably always read a lot. And as a Mason, you've utilized your love for knowledge, and you've read a lot of Albert Mackey writings about Freemasonry. How much has that impacted your Masonic life, what you've read from Albert Mackey?
I'm glad you brought that up, because, as I said earlier, I like to make sure that what I'm reading is correct and, you know, scientific and that kind of thing. You know, you won't ever see me quoting the internet. You'll see me quoting the person who wrote the thing on the internet, and I'll only quote them if I see where they studied, where they got it, and that they're for real. And one of the things that
I was curious, because ever since I've known you, you've always referenced Albert Mackey.
Oh,
so
right.
I wondered, like, and now I have you on a podcast, I thought it'd be a good opportunity to ask you, like, how much has what you've read about Albert Mackey impacted your life as a Mason in Masonry?
Well, the only two, and this was again, the only two writers that I know are authoritative are Mackey and Albert Pike.
Right.
I haven't taken the time to find out. I've read a lot of other stuff from people, but I was wondering if anybody listening to the podcast can tell me another writer or philosophy of masonry that is considered authoritative, and we can figure out why he's considered authoritative, and I can start quoting him. It's a very funny thing. I'll tell the listeners, we used to have these kind of discussion groups like this. And Chris, and I didn't realize I was doing this. I was always citing Mackey. Everything I said was Mackey and maybe one Pike. And so
I busted your balls a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was. What's that?
I busted your balls a little bit about that.
You said, do you have anybody else to cite except Mackey? And I got very defensive because, you know, first of all, I didn't. And second of all, it was to me, it seemed like that was enough because the guy's very prolific. And
you're right.
He's a major world class mind. So that went on for a long time. And thank you for lightening up on that. But I would like, it's a very serious question, something I've been looking for. If anybody knows whether any of the other authors out there are considered authoritative and why, or authors that I haven't seen, I really need that.
Like if you're listening to this show, whenever it is, could be a year after this was released and you happen to be listening to it, go ahead and email Chris at onthelevelpodcast.com. And send us who you read, who are your Masonic authors that you trust. And we'll put a list up on our website of everyone's favorite Masonic authors for you to go get information. And here's the thing about it. This is why I busted your balls about it. Not to bust your balls, because what you're doing is the right thing. Like when I see a lecturer and at the end of his lecture, he has citations, I respect that lecture so much more than the person who just says a bunch of sensational things and says, thank you, have a nice night, and walks away. Like, I don't know what was real and what wasn't real. So the fact that you're citing a person makes it much more authoritative, whatever is being talked about. And it is good. People should do that. My problem with it was always, this isn't a person who has any authority to speak about Freemasonry any more than you or me. He's just a brother talking about what he thinks about the fraternity. It's not necessarily a Masonic author in the sense of a creator of Freemasonry. This is just a person who's passionate about the fraternity in the same way we are. And so
blasphemy.
I know. I didn't say that. But to me, it's like we are all searching for our own answers to this stuff. And if we take Albert Mackey as the definitive source of the meaning of everything in Freemasonry, we might lose some of our required critical thinking process to find our own answer if we just take his answer. I know that's not what you're doing when you cite him. You're actually sparking discussion when you cite Mackey, and this is what Mackey says about it. And then I know this about you and something I greatly appreciate about you. Whenever you're hosting any kind of dialogue, you make sure everybody talks. Whether they want to or not, you always look at them and say, what do you think about that, Chris? And you're forcing them to think about it. And even if they don't want to, when you call somebody out, they have to say something, they got to think about it. And so you're kind of forcing them to think about the topic. So don't think that I don't appreciate what you're doing. I just, I just like to bust your balls. That had nothing to do with saying you were wrong for that at all.
I need to say this. You are right. Quoting one source is not the way things should be done. It should be a lot of sources.
Yeah.
One of the problems is he wrote so much that nobody else is even close. And
you're right.
I only cite him blindly when he hasn't, given the derivation, but he often, takes you through the whole logical steps.
Yes.
That lead him to what he says. And that's another reason that people respect him. So, but it's hard for me to describe the volume of the material, and it's hard for me to describe the great support and thinking that went into that stuff. So I've never been one to just cite one person, but like I say, I can't find any other, and his is just so good.
It is good, and it is logical too. You're right. When you read what Mackey writes about things, you always wind up shaking your head, I think, on, yeah, I guess he's right. I could see that.
Let me give you an example. I think I just opened up one of his books, and in there it says, Masons revere labor.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I never heard of that. And he goes into all this, you know, and it makes sense once you hear that, because we're all about labor, the working tools, and we're building something.
Yeah,
but he says we hate hermits because they don't make anything. And that's just an example of dozens of things that you'll read something and you look at the bottom and it was written by Albert Mackey. So I don't want to focus too much on him. I want to get some other people. And so if anybody else knows,
yes, send it in.
Authoritative writers.
Send us your favorite Masonic writers so that we can publish it and Dave can have new sources to cite.
Dan Brown doesn't count.
I don't think Dan Brown is a Mason or was a Mason.
Yeah.
He just he just wrote about things that involve Masonry.
Yeah.
I had Jeremy Barnes on the podcast, who's the creator of Amity. And he was the master of the poem.
Yeah.
Do you know Jeremy?
No, but I heard the podcast.
Okay. Yeah. He actually met, you know, Dan Brown did research in his lodge and he wrote the book the year he was the master.
Wow.
Yeah. And there's a character like whose hand got cut off that could potentially be Jeremy. So it's a really small world Masonically in the United States. This is one of the great things about our fraternity is that we're supposed to be finding our own answers. We're supposed to be asking these questions and taking in other sources and deciding for ourselves what's right and wrong, because there is no real dogma to the fraternity that says you must believe this. Really, it's more about, like you said, we revere labor, so our dogma is more about you must do this. If you want to be a good person, you must do charity. If you want to be a better person, you must help other people. You must listen to other people. You must try to subdue your passions. We're all about like what we should do to become better. That's our dogma, is like action. And if you're not doing the work, how are you ever going to become a better person? It takes effort and labor and work. It's hard work to change negative things about yourself. Really hard work. And it's even
I would agree 50% with that.
Hey, that's
because I think there's also a lot to be said for studying.
Yeah, because studying can give you ideas. And it can start taking you in, like when you see how somebody interprets something, it can kind of like spark your own ideas about things and say, oh, I never thought about that. I never really imagined it meant that. And it's happened to me many times, and we've talked about it. Like, there's a part of our ritual in the opening and closing of our ceremonies called the battery. And I'm not going to say what it is or when it happens, but you know what I'm talking about when I say it.
Yeah.
And I came to you and asked, what is this?
The battery.
Not that battery. There's a really good joke, though. You know, what did the battery say to the bag of chips? If you're ever ready, I'm free to lay. Okay. That has nothing to do. I just made babies cry. Don't cry, baby. Don't cry.
That's great. That's funny. I love the sound effects.
Where was I going with that? The battery. Yeah, the battery. Yeah. This is a good example. A couple of us were wondering, what does this really mean? Why do we really do this? And we got some answers that made logical sense. And I think you gave me one, which was, well, there's a number. The number equates to the degree, and this is a signal to us as to which degree we're in, and that's why the battery is important. Logical. Mm. Makes sense. I get that. Mm. But I was looking for an esoteric answer that I never got. No matter how many people I asked, nobody really had a good esoteric answer for what's the symbolism of it. The logical reason behind it does make sense to me. But everything in Freemasonry has an esoteric meaning, too. So, I
have my opinion on that. My opinion is it means sit down and shut up.
But, you know what? But nobody does sit down when they do the battery in the opening and closing ceremony. It's like not related. Man. Is it? No, it's not. Everybody's already standing when they do that.
Is it to break the the bad things off of you to make your stone smooth?
That's how I take it, honestly. And so in my research, which was just asking people, I kind of understood the logical reasoning for it, and I get it. But that symbolic meaning and esoteric meaning, I had to come up with on my own. And I did adopt it, and it's forever going to be a part of who I am as a Mason now. Whenever I go to an opening or closing of a lodge, I close my eyes and I force myself to imagine those rough parts breaking off when I hear that. And more for one degree than another, because you need it more in that degree than the other. When you're about to go into a full business meeting, you better be preparing yourself to be a vessel for, what do we call it, uninterested brotherly love, like we're not passionate, uninterested. There's a word they use
for that. I don't know that word.
Nope. But I think that, like, that's one of the great things about our fraternity is that you can pull those little things out of it for yourself that nobody but you might believe, but it's not wrong if it's making you better. It's right for you. And that's kind of a beautiful thing about Freemasonry is that we're all having our own individual experiences, even though we're doing it together.
Well, I talk out of both sides of my mouth because I say that, young people need to learn stuff, learn it all before, go through the steps before they start giving their interpretations to it. But by the same token, there's something in one of the rituals, I won't say which, it talks about good and evil. And I changed it. I just felt like changing it. I changed it to good and bad. So, you're having a good day. There'll be a bad one. You're having a bad day. You'll have a good one. And I was not authorized to do it. It's not right. And I have no excuse for it. And,
are themes in the fraternity, right? The light and the dark, the good and the bad. Those are definite themes in the fraternity. Yeah. So you're not wrong in talking about it that. Because
that simple, man.
No, it was definitely about good and evil and how I think what you're talking about is where it's trying to tell us that inside of man, all men are good and evil. Like nobody's pure. Nobody's pure evil. Nobody's pure good. We all have both inside of us.
You taught me something, and that's just as mine is that, if you're having if everything's going badly, people say, I'm just a jerk, everything's going to go bad, never going to stop. But then there's a great good. Then there's a good part, and the same thing with the good. Everything's going well, be prepared because, a hurricane might hit you.
Actually, I've used your explanation of that to other people. I know you wouldn't be mad about that, but the same explanation you used, I've given it to people, because it does make sense to me. It does actually help people. I think it can help people to start looking at it that way. Like when the sun's shining, you better start planning for the darkness because that sun ain't going to stay out forever. And when you're fumbling alone in the dark, don't think it goes on for eternity. It's going to end. You'll find the light again. And so don't get lost in the darkness. Like keep moving forward. Like, hey man, those are good lessons for people.
I think I could just say, that reminds me of another thought, instead of just saying that's what it stands for. Yeah. So you sound smart. I just thought of that now.
Even on this podcast, because I talk a lot, people think I'm trying to be authoritative. So I have to repeatedly say, and again, I'm not trying to teach anybody here. I'm just telling you one man's perspective on this thing we're talking about. I can't speak for the whole fraternity, other than when I'm citing stuff out of here. That's the only time I'm speaking for the fraternity. Talking things out really does help. I mean, when I have like anxiety about something, I notice like when that, because my voice is evil, like I said, it's always feeding me negativity. So if I'm left to my own devices, I get darker and darker in the places that I'm thinking about. So for me, it's really helpful to talk about things. Because other people have way more positive outlooks on things than I do. And I can be like, oh, okay, I can see that, and I could take some of their positivity into myself. But I need to talk about it with people, or else I'm going to be a depressive person.
Yeah,
well, that's probably part of our like tribal need.
Well, I told you I make those crazy connections, so I must have been the medicine man in evolution, or the village idiot, or something.
I can totally see you with those big gauge holes in your ears, and like a bone in your nose, maybe.
Yeah.
And some paint on your face. Yeah, I could totally see that. Because you'd be stylish, man.
I'll have to give you some of those. I wish I had some examples, because they're really weird. Like
of your medicine man thinking?
Of my connections.
Oh, the weird connections you made.
Can you remember any of them?
Sheesh, we've talked a lot about space and the universe and the meaning of life and time. And we've talked a lot about psychology.
Actually, well, here's one.
That's one you gave me. REM sleep. When your eyes are going, when you reach that rapid eye movement part of your sleep, that's like when you're having the most productive sleep. And I've always known that, but you told me, oh, hey, modern psychology has this thinking that if you can reproduce that eye movement, you can process it in your waking mind.
Yeah.
So that
my boss also told me, he said, you know, when you're happy, you smile. It also goes the other way around. So if you're not happy, if you smile, it'll make you happier. And I'd like you to do some research on that, if you don't mind.
The physical act of smiling making you emotionally feel better?
Yeah. Like when you're happy, you smile. And it works the other way around. When you smile, you become happy.
It's true. It's so primal. I saw go look on YouTube for a clip of this like really old gorilla. And this gorilla is dying and almost doesn't really interact with the world at all anymore because the gorilla is so old and dying. But the man who actually taught that gorilla as a baby sign language and stuff came to see it on his deathbed, and that gorilla's face lit up with the most heartfelt smile and joy that you can imagine. And you're like, wow, this is definitely something like primal within us, that smiling, reflecting our happiness. So I know you're right about that. There's definitely a physical connection to the emotional happiness.
Yeah.
And maybe if you can fake it, you got to fake it till you make it. Isn't that
that's exactly what that means. Yeah.
If you're not feeling happy, just smile. You'll get there.
Yeah, and I'm Jewish, and a rabbi once told me, he says, you know, we told everybody, it was a sermon, he said, if you're not sure you believe in God, you know, go to services and go through everything anyway, and eventually you will.
Yeah.
You know, it goes both ways. If you believe in God, you'll go to the services. If you go to the services, it can help you believe in God. So,
well, we have covered brotherly love, brotherhood. We've talked about the superfluities of life and what that means to us as Masons. We've talked about doing our passions, as well as a lot of other crazy things on this short podcast. This podcast is by no means a huge deal, but it does get out there. So you're potentially now and in the future going to be heard by a lot of people that are Masons all over the world, and maybe by some people that aren't Masons. And so I always like to leave every podcast by giving our guests the opportunity to speak to those people directly. So as we leave, worshipful David Finkelstein on the way out, what would you say to those Masons listening today?
I would say, don't leave your new Masons in the dark. show them brotherhood. The brotherhood, you know, they're Masons. An EA is a Mason. And you want to show him brotherhood. And the way to show him brotherhood is to be his friend. Don't leave him, you know, sitting in the dark for a month until you hear from us. You know, call him, take him to lunch, go bowling, ball game. You know, show brotherhood to the new brothers.
I love it. It's never too soon to start showing that you care about somebody once they join the fraternity. They need it. That being said, for On the Level podcast, we appreciate worshipful David Finkelstein of Liberty Lodge and plural member at Sarasota Lodge, number 147, my home lodge. Woo, woo.
And there you go.
I hope you come back. I hope I didn't scare you away. Love to have you back on the show to talk more. All right. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
That's it for us on the podcast. We're out.